The Romans have had a very bad press, you know, among the Christians. The Romans are usually made out to be very bad people. They were certainly unkind to the Christians, and they were. They burned off. They disposed of an awful lot of them. They didn't burn all of them. They burned some. They fed some to the lions, and they did other unkind things to Christians. And I must tell you, the Christians returned the favor when they were able to do it. But the surprising thing is, the Romans were basically tolerant in matters of religion. Now, this is hard for us to believe, because we've read all the Christian propaganda that's labeled history. But it is true. If you have a polytheistic belief, if you believe in many gods, then you have to be tolerant. This is one of the fundamental assumptions. If I believe in 7 gods, and you believe in 13, and our other neighbor believes in 117, and somebody down the street has 253 that he worships, then who can say any one of us is wrong? Who can hope to correct another of his fellows? Each one of us simply has to accept. You can have your gods, I'll have mine. Now, of course, this was the reason why it was so very easy for many peoples in the ancient world to accept the Roman emperor as god. Because they already had several, and what's one more or less? It's no skin off anybody's nose. It's very simple as you go through the marketplace and there's an altar in honor of the god emperor to leave a pinch of incense there. That is, it's simple for everybody but the Jews and the Christians, who find this, of course, impossible. This I was speaking about last time. But let's contrast what the people were like who were the educated Romans and who were instead the Christians as they began to come up in the world. An educated Roman was a bilingual gentleman, as I've been saying. He knew both Greek and Latin. He was fluent, learned in rhetoric, in literature, in mathematics, in the arts. He was delighted with all kinds of ideas, given to disputing little points. If he'd been well educated, he'd had much practice in disputing little points with everybody. He liked to toy with any kind of question, whether it had any meaning or not. It was fun to play with. You remember that very telling point when Jesus was brought before the Roman governor, Pilate. Imagine yourself as Pilate, a Roman governor, well educated in the Greek schools. He'd studied with the rhetors. Here he's confronted with a rather rough countryman, a fellow from a small town who's been going around preaching a doctrine that's disturbing everybody. Nobody seems to agree with him. Certainly nobody in his own group of people who is anybody important agrees with him. So Pilate asks him a question that anybody trained in the Greek schools would have asked him. What is truth? He really wanted to have a pleasant little argument. He wanted this rather simple man standing in front of him, a workingman, to lay out what he thought truth was, and then they'd have a nice dispute. It would have been fun. But Jesus wouldn't play the game with him. He couldn't, because his own conception of truth was simply not one that one could fit into a Greek-style argument. So he answered him not at all, which was the only answer he could give. Now the Christians in general, as the doctrine developed, of course, were not of this world, as I've already said, and as you already knew anyhow. They were otherworldly. As my old dean down south used to say, if I believed, as St. Paul did obviously believe, that the end of the world is at hand, that God is coming to claim his own, then we better knock off every evening and have prayer meeting. And this isn't in the least sacrilegious. This is precisely what the Christian would believe, and did believe. He abjured the flesh. He disdained the false learning of the Greeks and Romans. What good will it do a man to know Homer, to be able to sing it beautifully to the accompaniment of a lyre, if his own soul is in jeopardy, and Homer will even jeopardize his soul with all the improprieties of that poetry? What good will a study of geometry do a Christian? What good could it possibly do to learn to measure the earth? God measures the earth, and God alone needs to measure the earth. I need no such knowledge in order to save my soul. There even creeps into the Christian doctrine, and there even is still in the Christian doctrine in the more fundamental sects, which in this spirit are closer to the original church than the rest of us are. There even creeps in the feeling that any learning in particular is not a good thing. It's a dangerous thing. It'll cause us much trouble. If we concern ourselves with the present, with present situation, with present learning, we are departing from the true faith. I used to follow the Back to the Bible Hour when I lived a bit farther west and could pick it up on my radio rather easily. And I remember about 10 years ago when the gentleman who speaks so fervently on that program brought in a question one morning that one of his friends had raised with him. The friend had been saying to him, "Why is it that you never talk about the ills of the present day? You don't talk about juvenile crime, you don't talk about broken homes, you don't talk about world problems. You don't talk about anything that has to do with the present time at all." And after he'd raised this question at some length, the minister then said, "I'll tell you why I don't. Those problems don't have any meaning. Those problems are problems of this world now, and this world now just isn't going to last. God in his own day is going to bring it to an end. And I'm not referring to the atomic bomb. I just say God's going to bring this world to an end. And when he does..." Then he was off again on his usual approach to his religion. Very fervently believed. This is what the early Christians did, just exactly the same way. They could do nothing but spurn the old learning. Now, of course, this has even got into our folklore. I'm very interested in that fact. The folklore even works its way up into the learned circles. I shall never forget, no matter how long I live, the day that it was announced that the first atomic bomb had been dropped. Now, if you're about my age, or even a little bit younger, you probably remember it, too. Mr. Truman, who was then president, and Mr. Churchill, who was then the prime minister, arranged to have a joint program, speaking each from his own capital, and together they would announce what had happened. Mr. Truman came on and gave a rather matter-of-fact announcement of what had transpired, explained, as much as one could explain in general in those days, what had happened. Then very shortly on came Mr. Churchill, with this sonorous rhetoric of his, beautiful voice rolling out these great periodic sentences. He said only a few sentences, however, quite well-chosen language, as a gentleman of an earlier day or of this day might do. One of them I wrote down, and I've kept it ever since, though it's been now 16 years. And I remember it even without writing it down. He referred, in 1945, to the knowledge of the structure of the atom, long mercifully withheld from man. And I wrote it down because it struck me as so strange. Why should any knowledge be long mercifully withheld from man? It's a beautiful sounding phrase, I admit. But what does it mean? Who or what would withhold any knowledge from man? And why should any who or what withhold any knowledge from man? It may be possible now that we have mastered some knowledge of the structure of the atom to revolutionize the whole system of our life. to replenish the supplies of fuel which are waning, or which will wane as the number of people grows, to ship materials long distances overland or oversea, to bring in, for instance, when we've learned how to desalt the water, to bring in water and render fertile the desert plains throughout the world, and make it possible for more of us to live better. It certainly is possible already to take our knowledge of the structure of the atom and apply it to tracing the course of disease through the human body or through plant life or through animal life, learn more about improving our health, improving our crops, improving our stock. Would this kind of knowledge be mercifully withheld from man? Certainly not. And yet here a man of great eminence and great intellect lapses into the folklore at a critical point and refers to the knowledge of the atom and its structure as being long mercifully withheld from man. I say this is folklore. And the early Christians wouldn't be surprised by it at all. They would recognize it. It rings true. Knowledge is something for God and not for us. At the same time, they looked at the Romans, as you know, who to them were decadent folk, ornamented, bejeweled with their learning and their fine phrases, but not worth anything. They looked at them and said, almost in so many words, "We will bury you." And they did. Now the conflict, of course, was one really of basic idea as to what is the wrong thing or the right thing to do. To a Roman brought up in the Hellenistic education, the worst thing that could be said of him would be that he had been foolish, that the course of action he was pursuing was sheer folly. To the Christian, the word had no meaning. The only thing foolish he knew was sin. And the word sin had no particular meaning to the Hellenized Roman. These people simply didn't understand each other. Now, they had different educational problems, as you would expect, as I promised you I'd talk about. As I see it, the Christians had basically two kinds of problems in the sphere of education, or in spheres that would interest us in education. The first one was simply overwhelming, if you stop to think about it. Here they had an extraordinary doctrine of a triune God based on some ancient writings and some writings of about their own day, which must be understood at least in part in order to be able to participate in the faith. And they had to spread these doctrines round through a world which was largely unlettered and unlearned. As I've already said, the people who were most receptive to the doctrine were those who were unlearned and even unlettered. Now let me give you the assignment. You take a doctrine as involved as the Christian doctrine was almost immediately, and you go and teach it to people who can neither read nor write. How do you do it? Well, we have motion pictures nowadays. They didn't have those 2,000 years ago. We can use flannel boards, and certainly the missionaries do use flannel boards. We can use posters, printing, and all kinds of things. You can act out little plays if you want to. This has been done at times. It takes quite a bit of organization and personnel to do that. So if I send you out all by yourself, just one man, and you go into an alien community, and you are to spread the doctrine, just what do you do? There aren't any books, and if there were any books, the people you want to convert couldn't even read the books. Now this requires some thought, and it requires some organization. The earliest of the Christians, who were of course Jewish, had already behind them the Hebrew tradition of learning. By the time the Christian movement was beginning to spread round, it was accepted in all Jewish communities that every Jewish boy, at least, should learn something of the tradition of his fathers. And he would go on certain days to the synagogue and there be instructed. The kind of learning he had is what any boy in the ancient world would have. He would learn to form the letters. He would learn enough of the ancient language to be able to speak it. Now remember, this was an ancient language then. Hebrew even then was a dead language. The language that little Jewish boys spoke in Palestine was then Aramaic, or they spoke the vernacular wherever they lived. The Hebrew was to them an ancient dead language. They would learn to read it, more particularly to say it, from letters in front of them. The teacher in the synagogue would have a scroll or a part of a scroll, and he would teach them passages. If he were a man of some learning himself, he would teach them things that he didn't have copies of, as, for instance, the Psalms or parts of the books of prophets. He would say these things, and the boys would repeat them after him, just as the little boys to the north in Greece had long since learned to say Homer after a man who remembered passages from Homer, or as the boys to the south of them had learned the aphorisms and the ancient writings among the Egyptians. Now the little Hebrew boys in the synagogues learned the ancient writings. Now, I might remark parenthetically, this wasn't as hard as one may think it is, because fortunately the Hebrew is a very regular language, and it's rather easy to learn to read it, even if you don't know what it says. And so, of course, some of the boys in the synagogue schools simply learned to read passages without even knowing what they meant. This has been done in lots of religious groups. It's done even nowadays. Down in Ethiopia, my young men from Ethiopia have told me of going to school and learning to read their ancient language, in which their religion is embodied, Ge'ez, which is another Semitic language very like the Hebrew. It also is quite regular. One can learn to read it. There are not different pronunciations for the same pattern of letters. So even a boy of 4 or 5 can learn to read the Bible in Ge'ez, without even knowing what he's saying. And this is done. I remember quoting to a friend of mine who is a professor of history of education at the New York University, who is of Orthodox Jewish family. I remember quoting to him what one of my Ethiopian boys had told me about standing up in the church and reading from the Bible, pronouncing the words quite correctly and with proper phrasing, when he was 5 years old. He didn't even know what the words meant. My friend snorted and said he was a little bit slow. They had me doing that at 4 in the synagogue. And I have no doubt they did. I say the Jewish boys had this tradition, and the Jewish families had this tradition of boys learning to read, learning from the symbols, the ancient writings. But when you go beyond the Jewish community and begin to take in Gentiles, as Paul urged his followers to do, then you don't spread the Hebrew writings the same way. So you don't teach people just to read the marks on the paper, whether they know what they say or not. You have to teach them some doctrine. So now we're back where I was. How do you teach unlettered people doctrinal matters? How do you explain the Trinity? How do you explain, in later day as the doctrine developed, the virgin birth? How do you explain the meaning of the resurrection? These are very abstract questions for unlearned people. Now here the early Christians had recourse to a device which I mentioned the other day was used among the Greeks. They were able to set up questions and answers. Who was Noah? You define who Noah was. What did he take on the ark? How many days was the ark afloat? What was God's sign to him that the flood was over? And so on, so on, so on. One can raise many, many questions. Now you begin to recognize what the Christians did. They began to develop a catechism. They set up basic questions, which were definitive of the doctrine, with formulas for answers, just as the Greek schools had done the same thing in what they called history, where their history was what gods were on the side of Troy, and they would list them in alphabetical order, what gods were on the side of the Greeks, and they'd list those, which gods protected Hector, which gods stood by to protect Achilles, which battles were fought in what order, and so on. This had been done in the grammar schools of the Hellenistic world for quite a little while. The Christians adapted this technique to their own needs. They used Christian questions rather than Greek questions. They set up, in fact, two kinds of schools. One school, the lower school, is always referred to as the catechumenal school, C-A-T-E-C-H-U-M-E-N-A-L, the catechumenal school. A catechumen is a beginner, a pledge, a novitiate, somebody who's just learning the doctrine or thinks he wants to learn it. And the catechumenal schools were the simpler schools for these folk. Then the schools properly called the catechetical schools, where much more was learned of a catechism, were schools for training the elders, for training the leaders of the local churches. Now, some of the writings 50, 60, 70 years ago on the history of education always refer to these as elementary and secondary schools. This isn't right, of course, because one couldn't really call the catechetical schools secondary schools. They were more advanced elementary schools, if you want to come down to it. And most of the students who went to both kinds of schools were not children anyhow, or even young people. They were much more likely to be adults who were being inducted into the Christian faith. One of the most interesting early Christian writings in the field of education is a book on catechizing by St. Augustine, and I'm going to refer to that in a few minutes. But now I want to turn to the other point, the other problem which the Christians had, which was of an educational nature. This was a matter of refining their doctrine, of presenting it in a way that it would be attractive to persons who were not unlettered, who were not unlearned, but were indeed more learned. Now here, of course, they couldn't possibly escape the Greek tradition. No matter how much they despised it, they couldn't escape it. Man after man who was converted to Christianity, even St. Paul himself, as I have said, had had an excellent Greek education before he became Christian. When you list all the early saints of the church, many of them were men of a good, thorough Greek education before they were converted to the Christian faith. St. Augustine himself was a good case in point in a later century. When you bring a man over who has had a good grounding in Platonic doctrine, in the teachings of Aristotle, in the writings of all the Greek philosophers, he can't very well abandon what he already knew. He will attempt to reconcile it with his new faith, as St. Paul did for chapter after chapter in his letters. But he won't leave it aside. It'll still be with him. Now, if you know about the development of philosophy in the ancient world, you know that by the time the Christian doctrine got going, there was a movement called the Neoplatonist movement. And most proper people, most professors in those days, most properly learned people in those days, were Neoplatonists. The Neoplatonic movement had taken the old concept which Plato had developed of immanent ideas, innate ideas, true before all time, existing in all places, after all time. They'd taken this old doctrine and moved it on to what was almost a religion. There had grown up, philosophically and almost religiously, a belief that as one moves closer and closer to understanding these eternal ideas, which are the truth of the world, that one comes closer and closer to a grasp of the innermost integral truth of the world. There even came to be a word for this, the Logos, L-O-G-O-S, in the Roman writing. The Logos, which is the whole nexus of all the ideas which are eternal, which expresses the inmost secret of the world. I move toward it, I never quite reach it. Now, when the Christians were confronted with persons of some learning who had some conception of the Logos and the doctrines related to that, they of course had to square their new faith with it. And one of them, perhaps about 100 years after Jesus had died, living on the island of Patmos, up near to the coast of what is now Turkey, wrote the last of the Gospels. It is attributed to St. John. It's very easy to see, as you look at it, precisely what that author was trying to do. He was living among Greeks. He knew the Greek philosophy. He was writing a gospel for people who did know the Greek philosophy. And so he starts off significantly. In the beginning was the Logos. And the Logos was with God. And the Logos was God. Now we've had that translated, of course, in the King James Version. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Very obviously what the evangelist was trying to say was the doctrine which the Neoplatonists accept is not at odds with the Christian doctrine. The Logos, the eternal idea, the thing which pervades all the world, is God, is indeed the Christian God. I remember several years ago when I had a class of students reading with me Uhlic's History of Educational Thought. We were developing the Platonic doctrine of ideas, and I wrote on the board a great many words, beauty, justice, and mercy, and some concrete words like chalk and pencil and chair and table. Same sort of thing I was saying the other day to you. One of the words I wrote down was truth. And then I went on through with a lot of abstract and concrete concepts. And I tried to explain then the Platonic idea of ideas. And finally, one of my students interrupted me and said, I think I see what you said. I think I see what's wrong. Except for one thing. When I look at the word truth, I keep thinking there is something which is true, which is true before all time and true after all time. And I looked at him and said, the trouble with you is you're a Christian. Then the class laughed with me, because this was just the point I was after. The Platonic conception came into Christianity. It couldn't possibly be kept out. It's part and parcel of us even now. Now, as I've said several times, St. Paul was an active agent in squaring the Greek learning with the Christian dogma. Do you remember how clever he was? When he got to Athens, as he walked about in the marketplace in the central part of the city, he came to an altar which had on it a label which said, "To the unknown God." Now, the Athenians were awfully careful people. They put up altars to every possible god, and then in case they might offend some god they'd not heard of, somebody had thoughtfully put up an altar to the god they'd never heard of, so he wouldn't be offended by their leaving him out. Paul, having been well trained by persons who were directly in the line of the sophists, stopped in front of the altar and said, "This is the one I meant to talk about. I came to preach to you about the unknown God." And then off he went into his usual speech. He made a number of converts. You remember even the passages, I'm sure, that's in the Gospels that describes a little incident that is reputed to have happened during the last week of Jesus' life on earth. When somebody brought to him a piece of tribute money with the picture of Caesar on it and tried to prick him by asking him what should be done with this kind of money. It was the kind of question anybody with a little Greek background would put to a man who might possibly get himself into difficulty by not answering it correctly. Because there isn't any correct answer. This is why it's a nice Greek question. If Jesus says that the tribute money should be paid, then the Jews will despise him. If he says the tribute money shouldn't be paid, well, then he's into hot water sure enough. And so the text reports what it is said that he said. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, unto God the things that are God's. Now, I have a sneaking suspicion that some good pious Christian with a little Greek learning added on this story years and years later. Just doesn't fit with the rest of Jesus and what he said. Here is a man to whom all things in the world are God's. There is nothing that exists that is not his. And how would he stoop to such a Greek trick, such a cheap Greek trick, as this kind of play on words? But somebody later, as I say, had been at the Greek schools, tried to think back to what the master might have said, and put down the story, and then, of course, you could always point to it as the Gospels were circulated. You could point to it as it was shown to the Roman governor and say, "Look, look, 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 even our master was a nice Roman too, and we won't cause you any trouble. We're good Romans the same as anybody else." Now, I've mentioned two educational problems, two problems of an educational nature which the Christians encountered. One of educating the unlettered, the unlearned, and the other one of regularizing their doctrine, squaring it up with the Greek learning, which they did gradually, as I've tried to say. The Romans, of course, at the same time, were encountering educational problems of their own. Now, from our point of view, first and foremost, was the very hollowness of what their schools were teaching. The hollowness of rhetoric, which was ornamental, decorative, but at root was meaningless. Now, I repeat, I don't think the Romans were thoroughly aware of this, and they were perfectly happy with the learning that they had. But from our point of view, we would see this as an educational problem. There was the problem of the inner decay of the society. It was falling apart at the seams. And there were all kinds of teaching going on. Oh, good heavens, if you could have gone down the streets of Rome, it's just like Los Angeles is nowadays. You go down the streets in Los Angeles, I'm told, and on one side there's a Buddhist temple, and on the other side there's something Muslim, and down the way you can learn the Hindu doctrine, and down the way you can have a million different kinds of Christian doctrine, and a whole lot of other doctrines that don't belong to any of these groups at all. You could spend 95 years learning different religions down the streets of Los Angeles with excellent teachers who are glad to collect a fee from you. You could have in Rome the same way. Rome was the crossroads in the center of the whole world. All roads led there. And every kind of teacher went there to seek his fortune. It's most interesting to see how many different kinds of religions were competing in the last days of Rome. Sometimes I've been tempted even to speculate why it was the Christian doctrine won out, because there were some other good ones going around too. They were also powerful at various times. If you happen to know about this, you know how much fun one can have tracing the spread of certain of these religions. One good device for doing it is, as one of my friends used to call it, counting tombstones. Go get the great volumes called the Corpus Inscriptionum Latinorum, a collection of all Latin inscriptions. Find the various tombstones. Read what was said on them. Now, the Romans tended to put more on tombstones than we do nowadays. Not very many more words, of course, but they conveyed more message, and they did it, of course, in a cryptic form. They put on initials. Well, one we would know is IHS in hoc signo. And you know, if you know the Christian symbolism, the in hoc signo, abbreviated this way, and yet the IHS is also the iota, eta, sigma, which again is cryptic for the name Jesus. So if I find a tombstone somewhere tucked away in a corner of Italy or off up in Gaul or over in Spain with an IHS on it, I know I'm dealing with a Christian. Now, you can find more, as I say, on the Latin tombstones than you can on the modern ones. If I go into an ordinary graveyard nowadays and look at the tombstones, I'm a little hard-pressed to tell the religion of the person who has been interred there. Oh, of course, if his name is Francis Xavier O'Malley, I'm fairly sure he didn't go to the Lutheran Church. Or if there is the Star of David on the tomb, then I have an idea of the faith to which he adhered. But I might come upon a tombstone with the name of one of my friends, Martin Luther Beck, who's a Methodist minister. This throws you off a bit. Or the eminent Baptist minister whose name is Luther Wesley Smith. This will throw you off absolutely, but the Romans were more tidy about this. The names they gave and the inscriptions they put told you a bit better what they were saying. One schoolmate of mine many years ago studied the spread of the cult of one of the Egyptian gods, Serapis, up through Italy, and found tombs on which the devotee of this ancient Egyptian god from thousands of years before had engraved the letters which will say, "I too was a follower of Serapis." I've read recently of one tombstone which has been found up near Nuremberg, clear up in Germany, way out where the legions stood guard at the edge of the empire. Here's a tombstone engraved with symbols which plainly say that the man who was interred there was a follower of the prophet Zoroaster. The date of the tombstone is the early 5th century. Now hold tight a minute. The early 5th century, of course, is very late. By then, many of the Roman emperors had been converted to Christianity. Long since, many of the upper-class folk were Christian. By the early 5th century, of course, the empire was crumbling all over. And Zoroaster, of all things, was not a prophet of the Western world, but a prophet from Persia, way over in Iran, 600 years before Christ. 1,000 years later, way off out the edge of civilization itself, here a soldier died, and his friends put on his tombstone that he followed Zoroaster. Strange kind of thing, and it leads you to speculate. If I had more time, it would lead me to speculate why it was the Christian doctrine won out. Now, the kind of learning which the Romans had, the old Hellenistic learning, as I'm saying, was being buffeted considerably by the development of these various sects, some Christian, some not. From all sides, persons were being pulled away to learn strange new doctrines. and as the decades stretched on out into centuries, eventually the Christians began to come to the top of the heap. You remember that at the beginning of the 4th century, the emperor himself, Constantine, was converted. And when he was converted, he took with him his whole army. By the ancient story, he had them baptized, marching into the stream, holding their swords aloft, for the double purpose of not rusting the sword, and so that their right hands didn't dip into the water in case this might interfere with their fighting prowess. Then Constantine also established, for political reasons, a new city, his capital city, over near the Black Sea, Constantinople, and as I remarked last hour, established there a center of learning, which became a center of Christian learning, of course. I've mentioned two problems now which had to do with the development of Roman learning. Maybe the opposite of development, the decay of Roman learning in the days when the Christians were rising. The first one, the hollowness of the rhetoric, was one, as I say, that wasn't perhaps too well appreciated at that time. The second one, the decay of the society, became somewhat more obvious as time went on. The pressures from different groups who had different ideas of what should be learned. This is part of the decay of the society as I'm speaking of it. This one was something people were aware of. Now the third one was another thing that people were quite aware of. And it's very hard for us to summarize in a few minutes. This was the pressure, the intrusion of barbaric hordes from outside the empire in upon the empire in waves and waves and waves. Now if it had happened all at once and suddenly some armies had come in, or maybe 25-year intervals or 50-year intervals they'd come in, then we could talk about it rather neatly and say what happened. But it's awfully hard to say, at this point, education was such and such, and then a certain barbaric horde came in, and then it changed, and in two more centuries somebody else came in, and then it changed some more. We can't do it, because the thing was too irregular. And so all we can say is that as you follow through the first, the second, more particularly the third, the fourth, the fifth centuries, gradually learning, the centers of learning, decay. Some are knocked off their base, literally, by barbaric armies, barbaric tribes as they came in. Now some of the barbarians came in rather nicely. Some of them were almost polite people. Some of them were like the wetbacks that come across from Mexico in recent years. They come in a little bit illegally, but with somebody willing to hire them. Some of the tribes came in that way a few at a time. They settled in a piece of land that nobody particularly wanted. They reared there a family. Gradually they got to be decent people. If it had been nowadays, they'd gradually get elected to the legislature, and maybe even to Congress. They did the same sort of thing. And then somebody in the neighborhood was attracted to the daughter of the family, a blonde, blue-eyed girl, and married her. They settled down and were very decent people. This sometimes happened. It happened enough, of course, that by the time many barbarians had begun to come even into the north of Italy, we find the people in Rome beginning to be worried about the effect on them of having these people up in the north of Italy. I know there's one letter I've read that remains from about the 3rd or the 4th century, one Roman writing to another saying, terrible things happening. There aren't any good Romans, not any true Romans left at all. Every young Roman of good family that I know has gone off up north and found himself a blonde, blue-eyed wife and married her. It ruins the race. So there was this visible decay of the race, as far as the Romans could see, intermarriage with barbarians. But the decay that's most noticeable educationally, of course, is what happened in the towns where barbarians came in and destroyed the desire for learning, or the old villas that they conquered, left isolated as islands, Here and there you can be sure they took cities. Most places where they took cities you can be sure. The property rights were disrupted. No longer could the money come that might support the Rhetor in the town. Maybe the Rhetor hung on for the rest of his life and somehow was supported if he happened not to be killed in the invasion. Maybe even he was succeeded by somebody who went on and taught for a while without much money coming in. But after a generation or two or three, then the Rhetor school was gone. In some places it was. Now, in some places it remained. We have evidence of that because the learning did keep alive here and there in places where we know barbarians came in. Nonetheless, either the city was bypassed, or else the property rights of the Rhetor were not disturbed, or else something happened that made it possible for Rhetors to keep on teaching. We know that this happened some places. But in general, the picture is rather dark. I'm reminded of something I heard of last year. A British journalist, I heard, visited in Poland after the First World War, traveled back and forth in the areas which had been completely laid waste in that conflict. He came to the country estate of an elderly gentleman, and he found the old gentleman in his house, which had been left standing in the midst of all this scene of desolation. The house itself had been seriously damaged, but one part was not. It just happened that the library was not bothered at all. The books were still in place. The old man was in his library, reading, as a gentleman of his generation would be. The British journalist was talking with him when the son of the house came in, a young man in peasant's dress, whose education had been cut short by the war. He came in from the fields where he'd been working, ill at ease in the library, a complete stranger to the world of the mind in which his father was at home, and into which he would never be able to enter. Later, when the journalist thought back, he wrote, "I bade him, the old man, and his empty house a regretful goodbye." In the twilight centuries when the barbarians surged over the Roman provinces, there must have been lonely villas left standing amid the ruins of the empire, in which old men survived, cramming Greek manuscripts while the Goths enjoyed their wealth. Not all at once, nor without the flicker of a false dawn, did the darkness compass them round. As the months of desolation lengthened into years, those old men hoped for the return of civilization, and dying, prayed that their sons would live to see it. Their sons lived like barbarians, dimly remembering the interrupted studies of their youth. Their sons' sons were barbarians born. The old learning did die in this way, gradually, here and there, with a flicker, and then it was out. Yet I say, I repeat, some of the learning was kept alive in some places, for reasons we don't now know, so that it was not lost entirely everywhere. Now the Christians meantime picked up some of the cause of learning, carried on some learning. I remarked a bit ago that one of the early Christians, St. Augustine, not really of the earliest group because he lived in the 5th century even, wrote a book on how to teach school. He called it On Catechizing. And I think it would be worth stopping to see what he had to say. Augustine, you will recall, was a Roman of North Africa in the days when, as I think I quoted last hour, These fellows said they were more Roman than the Romans. And this very Roman young gentleman, when he had exhausted all the learning that was possible, all the learned people it was possible for him to meet in the north of Africa, took a boat and went over to Rome, took his wife, took his mother and their servants, because he was a man of wealth. He was a young man, 19, 20 years old. He settled down in Rome, and there learned from all the kinds of teachers I've described there were in Rome. Men of all faiths, men of all philosophies, including certainly the Christians. He wished to pursue a life of learning. He wanted to become a rhetor himself. And it's rather interesting that he did become a rhetor up in Milan. Now, if you look at Milan on the map, you find it way in the north of Italy. Then you check back the dates and see that this was at the end of the 4th century, the beginning of the 5th. And you know it was only a few more years, 2 generations, when Rome itself fell. And you know that there were barbarians all around, but still, in Milan, there were teachers of rhetoric. And for part of his life, Augustine was one of them. I'm trying to say, you see, some of these rhetor schools were alive, despite the incursions of the barbarians. When he reached his late 20s, early 30s, he finally decided he would become a Christian. He declared this, became priest. His wife he had long since put aside. And in a few years he was sent back to Africa as bishop, and there achieved great reputation, deservedly, because of his contributions to Christian learning and writing. Now, one book that he wrote, it's a little book, but it's a most interesting book on how to teach school. As I say, the title of it is On Catechizing, How One Teaches. One of his friends, who was the bishop over at Carthage, asked him to write the book explaining how he taught, because his reputation as a catechist was so great. Now, among other things that he says, he points out something that we would phrase as being that one must recognize individual differences. When one deals with the unlearned, one wishes to be sure that they know all the ancient meaning of the religion, all the traditions, all the stories of the Bible. And so one says to them very quickly, he points out, do you know about Noah? Of course they don't know about Noah, so then you tell them the story of Noah. Do you know about Samuel? No, they don't even answer you, they just look at you. So you tell them the story of Samuel. And so on through until you're sure they know all the stories, and he tells how you must quiz them back and forth and have them answer your questions until you're sure that they do understand these stories insofar as they're capable of understanding them, and insofar as they need them for the true practice of the faith. But he says, when you're dealing with a man who is truly learned, here of course he's becoming autobiographical, when you're dealing with a man who is truly learned, don't be overly tedious with him. Don't just say to him, I think you ought to hear the story of Noah, and then tell it to him, because he probably has already discussed this story at great length with other men. In fact, you can be assured if a man comes to you with considerable learning, he has certainly talked to many Christian philosophers before he comes to you. And so simply go down through the things that you think he should know and ask him, have you heard of such and such? And if he shows that he has by his response, why, summarize the main points so that they will be clear in his mind, and then go on. Ask him better what he's been reading. And if he mentions to you good canonical books, books which are well accepted by all of us, then praise him for his excellent taste and for the care which his teachers have used in directing him to the best books. This is a nice point of psychology that Augustine has in mind. If, on the other hand, the books which he's been reading are not good canonical books, then don't say to him they're bad books. This would not be, we would say nowadays, this would not be tactful. This is not a good thing, he says. If he's been reading The Power of Positive Thinking, or whatever the equivalent of that was in those days, don't tell him that's a bad book. Just say, many of us prefer, and then place in his hands a canonical book, and gradually steer his taste to better books. But then I like the touch of the ones that, as he says, have been at the schools. Now, being at the schools in those days meant studying at the Rhetor's schools. He says, when a young man comes into you who has been at the schools, you must bear in mind that the one thing most lacking in such young men is the Christian virtue of humility. I like this touch. And so he says, you can't take them at their face value. When they tell you they've heard something, don't accept it. Go ahead and tell them a story anyhow. So he goes on with a very practical handbook of how one teaches school. It's a very good text on method. Now, as the Christians grew in importance, they of course had to pick up some Greek learning and use it, some Roman learning and use it. And not all of it was impossible. Remember, one of the strongest philosophical groups in Rome was always the Stoic movement. Even the teacher of Nero, Seneca, was a great Stoic and had left sentences, moralistic sentences, which could be used by Christians. They were not at all offensive. Cicero had been a Stoic, as you probably recall. Some of Cicero's writings were possible. You remember the letter that Cicero wrote when his daughter had died. His friends wrote and offered their condolences. She was literally the light of his life, a lovely, charming, bright girl. I think you'll recall I remarked his son was something of a disappointment, and this daughter was his hope. And in her teens, she died. And so he wrote this beautiful essay of what it means to a father to have had a daughter. It's a Stoic essay. It simply assumes, as the Stoics do, this is a rough world. I don't expect the world to be friendly to me. It won't be. Whatever I have, the world will take away from me. When I don't have anything, it'll take away even what little I have. This was the basic belief. The strong man can face it, the weak man crumbles. And so Cicero writes to his friends, I had this lovely daughter, something few men are blessed with. I was blessed beyond most men, and I had her for a number of years. It lightened my whole life. Now she is gone, I remember her for what pleasure she was. Now, a Christian can use that very quickly. All he has to do is to put in, the Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, and off he goes. And so some of the Greek teaching it was possible for the Christians to use. They picked it up, reinforced their own teaching by adapting it only slightly. Wherever the missionaries went, they carried with them the Latin and the Greek. For what else would they use for teaching? Their own writings were in these languages. Now, as the Christians developed their own pattern in what we call the early Middle Ages, they set up two kinds of schools, which aren't entirely different. They set up what are known as cathedral schools and what are known as monastic schools. These are obvious enough, schools in cathedrals and schools in monasteries. But I should like to emphasize what the cathedral schools possibly were. A cathedral, as you know, is located in the principal city. It is the seat, I started to say, of the governor. It is the seat of the bishop. But in the polity of the church, this amounts to the same thing. And so a cathedral school, a school at the cathedral, at the seat of the bishop, which had been the seat of a governor, in many instances replaced the Rhetor's school And one even comes to guess that perhaps the Rhetor schools in some places, under the protection of some bishops, really became the cathedral school rather directly.